The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Oh, a happy day.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. This is the Empowerment Hour. I promise you, you will have insight, information that can improve the quality of your life, and hopefully alter some of our misguided perceptions. Conversations with Remarkable Minds continues with Dr. Jim Garrison. We're going to talk about climate change policy failures in the past year and what to look forward to in tackling global warming this year. Also, spiritual conversation on change of consciousness in the future. Why are not more individuals engaged in caring about their environment or the welfare of one another? Or are ridiculous policies around the world? Or eating genetically engineered food? Or eating junk food? Or having an epidemic of diabetes in children? All that we will talk about with Dr. Jim Garrison. Also on my 3 o'clock show this afternoon, Professor William Black. Again, Conversations with Remarkable Minds. He is a professor of economics and a professor of law at the University of Missouri. And we're going to talk about white-collar crime. In particular, why are we not seeing more people brought up on charges of the massive fraud that has occurred, the largest in world history, the largest transfer of money, and yet so few people held accountable. He was litigation director for the Kansas City Federal Reserve, and we share the fraud behind the recent banking crisis. And then tomorrow we'll have William Kartung, director of the Armed Security Initiative at the New American Foundation, talking about why is it that we are willing to bankrupt America, allow people to be removed from their homes, do not fund a national health care initiative that would cover everyone, see that we have enough food for people to eat, and yet, boy, do we give everything that is desired and more to an absolutely useless, utterly corrupt military-industrial intelligence complex with the largest private contractors in the world and how they impact upon our lives. And then also Gretchen Dubow talking about what's happening in Europe to take away their rights to use vitamins and herbs, how it's coming to the United States. And then Professor Paul Craig Roberts talks about what we who are independent and humanistic and progressive can do to challenge the U.S. becoming a totalitarian state. A lot of heavyweights, a lot of interesting insight, people you do not see or hear in the mainstream or alternative media, but you will be hearing them right here. Now let's go to the latest issues. And later on this program, time permitting, a lot on the environment, including the latest from Professor James Hansen. He's one of the more renowned environmentalists in the world today. He has been the head of and director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies. And he's going to talk about what we can do to save the environment if it's not too late. Also, the latest on how many people are committing suicide in India because they tried Monsanto's genetically engineered seeds and it didn't work. The number is staggering. But also Ralph Nader, a commentary I think is germane. And let us go to the latest on health and healing. First, eating red meat is going to increase a woman's risk of stroke. That's the latest study, and that is from the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm. Dr. Larsson there studied 34,000 women ages 39 to 73. All had no cardiovascular disease, no cancer at the beginning of the study. 10 years later, a lot of them had stroke. Stroke is caused by, of course, we know, a blockage of an artery that supplies blood to the brain. It's also known as a cerebral infarction. Why did this happen? Red meat. Those who ate the most red meat, and that was construed as 3 ounces at a serving, that's a small amount. 3 ounces is like maybe a large forkful. So we're not talking about what the average person eats. We're talking about the amount necessary to cause these strokes. And those who ate the least amount of meat or no meat, well, they didn't have the problems with strokes. And they already took into account things like smoking and diabetes and all these other risk factors. It was just the meat. One more reason to give it up. As many people in this audience know, anytime you challenge an existing belief system, the fact that you may have truth on your side and documentation from independent sources does not mean that those in power will say, okay, thank you for this new information, and we will change our scientific principles or medical practice or public health policy. Almost always just the opposite happens. Someone brings forth new information, like Rachel Carson on the dangers of DDT, and immediately she is attacked. Not just by one group, but the entire pesticide industry attacks her and uses the media to do so and tries to discredit her. In the end, she was proven to be completely right. They were proven to be completely wrong. Nothing happened to them for being wrong. But think of all the adverse reactions to people's health because no one listened to Rachel Carson in her book Silent Spring. So when we did the real research, and we're joined by people like Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who is to be commended for, under the Freedom of Information Act, getting the secret testimony of a Christian Conference Center meeting by the FDA, CDC, and the manufacturers of vaccines, where they talked about how do we cover up this problem in this study of 100,000 children showing that thimerosal, the mercury in vaccines, actually contributed to their autism. It's there in black and white, their own statements. But mind you, no one knew that their statements would be recorded and a transcript would ultimately end up in the hands of Robert Kennedy, and that transcript ended up in my documentary, Autism Made in USA. Until that time, they had what is known as plausible deniability. That means they could say, well, look, we, the official governmental agencies, the CDC, the FDA, the U.S. Public Health Service, the National Institutes of Immunology and Allergy, we say, along with the American Academy of Pediatrics and journals such as the American Journal of the American Medical Association, New England Journal of Medicine, we all say officially there is no connection. And the media, lapdogs that they are, and complete idiots that they are, and their incapacitation to ask any legitimate hard question from Chris Matthews and all the people on the left, and refuse to even have anyone on who would offer legitimate challenge. So needless to say, this has been an enormous fight. But guess who was on the side of right? The parents. The hundreds of thousands of parents. The millions of parents whose children took vaccines, were completely normal, and then ended up dead, damaged, or with autism spectrum disorders. And all the while, their pediatrician or nurse or one of these other clowns saying, there's no connection, there's no connection. Oh, by the way, lest we forget, weren't these the same institutions that for over 100 years refused to acknowledge cigarette smoking causing cancer and allowed pro-scientists from the tobacco industry to go in front of congressional hearings, especially the Southern lunatics from the South who were subsidizing tobacco and in bed with the tobacco manufacturers and say, there's no evidence. This is all nonsense. And so no one was able to win a lawsuit. In fact, to this day, we still would not have had a lawsuit won had it not been for the whistleblower coming forward and showing that, yes, the tobacco industry lied when it said that Did it know that its tobaccos were addictive? It did know they were tobacco. Tobacco was addictive. The FDA knew it was addictive. But the FDA, in order to protect the interest of the proprietary manufacturers, kept that secret. It was in their vault all along. That shows you what kind of interest the FDA has. In any case, here we are with vaccines. Not quite. Let me quote this. The paper attaches what I call solid biological research, and it lays the autism causation source as thimerosal, that means mercury, injections based on data that cannot be manipulated, as evidenced by cherry-picking of data used in epidemiological studies. Assuming this data from a major medical center research group is reproducible, then the argument about the safety of thimerosal, meaning mercury, in vaccines given to infants could be accurately evaluated. I get queasy in my stomach at the constant culling of manipulated epidemiological reports as good science. What good science requires first and foremost are researchers who are honest and who do not carry a bias. Epidemiological studies do not prove anything, and they are identified as failing if they cannot explain the biological effects reported in tightly controlled animal studies. Professor Emeritus of Chemistry, Boyd Haley, University of Kentucky, dear everyone, quote, in what seems to be an endless stream of studies published by researchers worldwide linking thimerosal, mercury, with autism, just today, yet another study by more well-established and well-respected researchers directly links mercury thimerosal exposure with autism, and yet another animal model system. This new study continues to build upon previous animal model systems linking thimerosal mercury with autism in flatworms, pond snails, mice, rats, hamsters, and monkeys. The new study, quote, lasting neuropathological changes in rat brain after intermittent neonatal administration of thimerosal, was published in the peer-reviewed journal Folia Neuropathologica by investigators from the University of Warsaw and the Marie Curie Chairs Program at the Department of Pharmacology and Physiology at the Nervous System Institute of Psychiatry and Neurology, Warsaw, Poland, and the Department of Biology and Environmental Sciences, University of Cardinal Stefan Wyszynski, Warsaw, Poland, funded by grants by the European Commission and the Minister of Science and Higher Education of Poland. This new study describes thimerosal, containing approximately 49% mercury by weight, has been used as a vaccine preservative since the 1930s. However, during the past decade, serious concerns have emerged regarding its safety in infants, young children, pregnant women. In the body, thimerosal is metabolized to ethyl mercury and subsequently into inorganic mercury forms, which accumulate in different organs and tissues, including the brain, where they can remain for months or years. With growing numbers of pediatric vaccines, many of which contain or still contain thimerosal in some countries, administered at very young age, infants, quote, have been exposed to increasing amounts of mercury with potential negative effects on their health. In fact, the years of the late 1980s and 90s, when infants were exposed to the largest ever doses of mercury in vaccines, coincide with the emergence of epidemics of pediatric neurodevelopmental disorders, including autism. Unquote. The investigators then stated, quote, we conducted a series of behavioral, neuropathological, and neurochemical studies examining the neurotoxic actions of thimerosal administered during the early postnatal period in rats. Our research revealed many neurobehavioral alterations in thimerosal-treated animals, such as impaired brain sensitivity and social interreactions, locomotor deficits, and increased anxiety, which resemble symptoms of autism. Here we have focused on neuropathology and report enduring morphological alterations in brain tissues from neonatal thimerosal-exposed rats, unquote. And then it goes on, and I have the actual studies in hand that I'm reading from, to show all these different studies that when you give the amount of mercury to an animal, any of these animals that you give to a baby, based upon equal weights, you cause autism spectrum disorders and neurological damage. So we have multiple studies, independent of government, which is biased, Because sometimes, without being aware of it, the government will say, but we have an independent study that showed there was no connection. Ah, independent? The vast majority of your advisors on your vaccine schedule are getting money from pharmaceutical companies making vaccines. When you give a grant, you gave a grant to an institution. That institution was then given the protocols by a vaccine manufacturer. So the fact that you paid for the study doesn't mean that the study was independent. The people who designed the study reviewed its outcome and had exclusive rights to how to be interpreted were the vaccine makers. Again, it's smoke and mirrors. So the real evidence, thimerosal causes autism. The parents were right. The advocates were right. We who are in public health science were right. We in the alternative independent media were right. And those on the left and right were wrong. Shame on the left. I can understand the right. But my God, has the left ever seen a drug that it didn't recommend? Next up, but I'm going to keep you on track because every one of these studies we're going to nail. Editorial from the Charleston Gazette in my home state of West Virginia, quote, many U.S. pharmaceutical firms hire foreign companies to test their new drugs overseas. The Federal Drug Administration does almost nothing to analyze and review those tests. Reporters Donald Bartlett and James Steele exposed the increasing use of dangerous, poorly tested drugs in deadly medicine in the January issue of Vanity Fair. After a dozen people died while driving a defective Toyota, Congress ordered many company executives to testify, answer tough questions. In contrast, prescription drugs for allergies, arthritis, diabetes, and other ailments kill 200,000 Americans every year. And this is a tragedy of routine nature that is completely overlooked. Quote, when the pharmaceutical industry meets with lawmakers, it is mainly to provide campaign contributions, unquote, according to Bartlett and Steele. In 2008, about 80% of the applications pharmaceutical companies submitted to the FDA had data generated by clinical trials in foreign countries. It's easier and cheaper to find volunteers for drug trials among people living in desperate poverty. Standards and regulations governing drug trials are weaker, and in most countries, some have no rules whatsoever. For many decades, clinical trials of new drugs were conducted and supervised by academic researchers at U.S. universities and teaching hospitals. Today, more and more independent private contractors are paid lavishly to conduct those trials overseas. Private contractors design and conduct field research. Now, how much do they get? Well, about $100,000 each. That's just pocket money. So go back to what I just said. So when any time the government tells you that something is safe and it was government funded, no. Government only gives money to insiders, inside organizations, insiders who are going to do what they want to do, and these are all pro-pharmaceutical people. So don't be confused when it says an independent study. No, independent of the government, independent of the industry making a drug, yes. But I want to see who paid for it. Who were the researchers? Do they have any pharmaceutical affiliations? Have they been paid consulting fees or stipends? Do they get honorarium? Do they get research scholarships? If they have a financial interest, then that study is tainted. And finally, probiotic bacteria strains can help produce a conjugated linoleic acid that may be able to modify fat tissue and help people lose weight who are overweight. I'm Gary Knoll, always with the latest in health and nutrition from the original scientific studies, never from the mainstream media, so you get to hear things here for the first time anywhere. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Get out of that bed, wash your face and hands. Get out of that bed, wash your face and
Welcome, all of you. I'm Gary Noll, and you're listening to the number one radio program in America for independent, progressive, spiritual, and humanistic minds. And there are a lot of us. We're just organizing. We're going to go to our guest, Jim Garrison. Dr. Garrison is going to talk about the environment, what went wrong, what has to go right, and also spiritually redefining our journey. Now, a short commentary from Ralph Nader, and then Kara Lee is joining us in studio. This is Ralph Nader tweeting away the time from commondreams.org. The start of the new year is a good time to talk about time. About this, we can all agree. There are only 24 hours in a day. Zillions of companies and persons want a piece of that time from us in order to make money. But that supply of time is not expendable. Unlike other supplies in the marketplace, this one has no give beyond 24 hours a day. Note the massive increase in commercial requests for our time in return for our dollars, directly or indirectly, compared to 60 years ago. Instead of three television networks bidding for our time in order to sell advertising, there are over 100 channels on any cable system. There are more radio stations, more online blogs, and websites, more video games, more music. In 1950, there were no cell phones, no iPods, no Blackberries, no emails, no text messages, no e-books, no faxes. Entertainment fare is now 24/7 and expanding rapidly on the Internet. But there's still only 24 hours per day. What are these merchants expecting of the consumer's time? Squeezing more into less time as attention spans shorten, for one, marketing so irresistibly that people buy far more of these videos and other entertainment services than they have time to view or listen to. Think of the VCRs and the DVDs piled up at home that have never been seen. Same for many books. The big bestseller on the universe, Grand Design by scientist Steve Hawkins, became status furniture on sitting room tables, except for the 1 in 100 who actually read the book. In short, the gap between what we think we have time for when we buy these products and what we actually expend time on is setting records every day. However, people all over of all ages are spending more time on casual gaming. 75 million Americans gamble on a regular basis. And apart from being addicted to compulsive and video gaming, there is some substitutions at play here. Emails and text messaging are taking a large slice out of the day, in part because they're so cheap and in part because they're so personal. What gives here is that less time is being spent on the telephone, but by no means an equal measure. So cheap and easy are modern communications that it's often harder to actually reach people during the day by a dial phone. How much time do we spend trying to get someone to return our calls or even to react to our emails during the day or week? After a while, one stops trying to make telephone contact because of the low probability of actually talking to a person you want to reach. People are so overloaded that they just getting them to respond to a friendly letter, calls, or electronic messages requires many repetitions. The banality of abundance is at work here. On the other hand, where you get quick replies are from your so-called friends with mutual gossip and personal tidbits, driving back and forth volume immensely. A 16-year-old girl said she sends 600 text messages a day and, quote, would die without her cell phone. Still, the sellers are more and more vigorously competing for a piece of the buyer's time. Where is all this going? First, the sales appeal may ostensibly be for the buyer's time, toys, DVDs, but it really is an appeal to the buyer's hope or belief that he or she has the time sometime. That is what gives what economists call the elasticity to the seemingly finite 24-hour day. Whether that time is devoted to the program or product is immaterial to the seller once the sale is made. The successful seller is happy. But what is happening to the buyer? More stuff piles up. More sense of being time burdened when weeks and months pass without getting around to using the purchased goods or services, more susceptibility to buying the newest upgrade or version out of a sense of getting to now what they haven't had time to get to before with the older purchase. Moreover, as a society of buyers, we become ever more fractured as audiences, especially for national television, and it's less likely that we see or react to the events of the day as a community. In conclusion, I was reminded of this observation recently when Washington's current outrage of endemic wars, waste, and corruption rattled the public far less than Nixon's Watergate behavior. In 1974, after Nixon fired his attorney general and the special prosecutor who were investigating his involvement in the Watergate burglary and cover-up, Tennesseans sent 40,000 telegrams to one of their senators over 3 days. Members of Congress, even with the ease of email and Twitter, do not get that kind of meaningful volume. When our time feels overwhelmed and the marketers are banging on our doors for more time claims, what time is there left for necessity, for solitude, for family, for socializing, for kids playing outside instead of being addicted to indoor screens, even at dinner? For, excuse the word, reflection and contemplation. It comes down to whether we have any time for our absorption into virtual reality to engage reality, including civil and political realities. A society whose people do not show up for public meetings and hearings and protests and even local folklore events is a society that is cannibalizing its democracy, its critical sense of community purpose. Take back some of those discretionary hours from the marketers and the electronic entertainers. Devote them to shaping the future for you and your children. Ralph Nader. Let's go into our studio and say hello to Kara Lee. Hi, Kara.
Good afternoon, Gary. Well, I just really quickly wanted to read a nice email I got earlier today from a man named Jason. He says that about 2 months ago, he had never heard of you before, and he said he lives a pretty well-to-do lifestyle, and around the holiday season, he likes to give to charity and help the poor. And then one of his friends said, come over and see how Gary Nall works with the poor. And after watching you and your interaction, now he realizes that many people are not engaging. You're going out there and you're talking to people and helping people, giving them a month's worth of food. And it said that it really changed his mindset. And now he actually feels embarrassed that all he used to do was write a check and get it over with. So he wanted to say thank you for showing him really how to help and that you really motivated him to go out and do more and interact with those communities.
Well, that's nice. Look, if he's able to see a human being or a family that's in need and to connect with them at the... Remember, here's how I would address this. Don't focus upon what I do, because each of us contributes what we can, but I believe that the best way to help a human being in need is to look that person in the eye, sit with them and ask them, friend, how can I help you now? What tools do you need? And if it's within your capacity to help a human being, then do so right then and there. Don't look at the people you do not have the resources or time or effort to help. Look at the person you can help. So I would rather help one human being or one family with something that is real to them, that will make a difference, than simply to send a check off to some charity. Many people recently found that when they sent money to the Haitian relief, the latest study shows that the vast majority of the money went to corruption, meaning it never reached the average person to buy them food or to get a new water supply system in, or to get sanitation system, or get housing. It went to those people heading the charities. In fact, the female companion of one of the big charities, suddenly this woman got $500,000 for who knows what, but it didn't get to the people. So I don't give to charities, ever. Instead, I give to people, directly. Now, I don't suggest everyone do that, but I suggest we have no shortages of people in our society we can help. Look at the churches and look at the community outreach groups that are there and have been there every day. They can use help. That's a good place. they're not stuffing that their pockets and that buying lavish homes and cars and taking trips and gambling. They are the front line. And thank goodness for these very spiritual individuals. One of those is Michael Dowd. Michael Dowd may not be known to most people in this audience, but he was one of the Camden protesters, along with the Berrigan brothers, who I knew. They used to eat all the time in my restaurant, the Fertile Earth, up on 108th and Broadway. And when I recently visited him at his Sacred Hearts Church in Camden, New Jersey, which is like a little oasis, a little mecca where people come because he's there to help them, and he does. And he has no staff. It's just him and some volunteers. And he has a Catholic school there, but they don't teach Catholicism because 98% of all their students are African-American Baptist. So rather than the school being permanently closed by the archdiocese, he said, no, we don't want any money from you. And you know he has not accepted any money from the Catholic Church, even though his is a Catholic Church. Boy, that's an exception. But he's an exception, and he's angry at the church. I was surprised when he was being filmed, and I stopped the filming, and I said, you know, I never want to catch someone in a moment of passion say something that later they regret. So I have no problem you restating your position. And he said, no. No, this is what I feel. I feel that the rabbis are hypocrites, and the priests are hypocrites, and the ministers are hypocrites if they're talking about Jesus or God in their religious ceremonies, and then not having that congregation go out and protest against the wars and human suffering. How can you say my congregation is well fed, but the stranger on the street is not? Which religion suggests that you do not help a stranger? All religions suggest that you help the poor and needy. But not today, unless it's the exception of the person themselves. And there are other people like him. He is not the only one by any means. In fact, the reason we got out of Vietnam in no small measure is because three things. A, the average person's family member came back in a body bag. And suddenly it was no longer John Wayne at the movies each night when they were seeing all this battle action, when we actually had freedom of the media to show us the real face of war and the suffering. But it was also that the congregations, so many congregations, led in no small measure by Catholic priests and nuns who went out there and to their great spiritual values committed themselves against that war, being rested, or whatever they were faced with. Today it'd be far harsher, because today we just don't arrest people. We really brutalize them. And so, good for him. So you bet I would give, and have, and will, to the individual who will see that a person is fed. But look at it this way. If you can help a person, take the time and do it. Because what if you were one day looking across the table and the person on the other side was your brother or sister or mother or grandfather or father or aunt or uncle or best friend, and they were then in need? Would you say, I'm writing a check to some charity. I'm sure somehow you'll be helped. Or would you say, friend, I will help you? Look in the eyes of the person that requires your help and give what you can. We all have the capacity to give something. We can give our compassion. We can give an ear. We can give our understanding. We can give some food. We can give clothing. We can maybe help a person look for a job. We found a homeless person on the street in a really bad night and took him to the health support group and introduced him. This person was a very articulate person, but had been on the street now for over a year. And by the end of the evening, someone had a job for them. So there's always something we can do. If we determine that we can help a person, I believe we have a moral responsibility to help. I think that my generation, the 76 million baby boomers, require a renewal of our faith in humanity. We had so much good that we engaged in, and then we had so much indifference that we pulled away that massive energy of creativity and social commitment, and then we build our McMansions and our egos and our trusts, and we produced a generation of entitlement babies, and we wanted everyone to become the best and brightest and go to Harvard and Yale. And they did, and they went then to Wall Street, or they went to Silicon Valley. And they did exceptionally well. The trouble is, the disparity between the have and have-nots grew so tremendously that today, those best and brightest, mainly from my generation, and we were the progenitor, they forgot about everyone else and sharing and caring about what products you produce. Does it help the environment or contaminate the environment? Does it help another human being or precipitate disease? Does it contribute to our sustainability, or does it diminish our natural resources? I believe it's time for honest introspection. And so when you see someone in need, stop and speak with them and see what a difference you can make. That's all I ask. Back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. Welcome all of you from all over the world, and more than one half of our listeners are now listening in countries all over, over 154 countries. My guest in this segment of our program is Dr. Jim Garrison. He is the co-founder and president of the Wisdom University in San Francisco. As the co-founder and president of the Gorbachev Foundation, he was instrumental in the founding of the State of the World Forum, which he remains as its president, in order to generate a global network of leaders and visionaries from all walks of life to define a template for a more sustainable global civilization. And the World Forum is now dedicated to tackling the environmental and social problems related to climate change and global warming. And he is also the author of some very important books, including Civilization and the Transformation of Power and American as Empire, Global Leader or Rogue Nation. He also will be co-hosting a new program, Voices of Wisdom, on the Progressive Radio Network, and that will begin in just about 3 weeks, on the 28th of this month, every Friday at 2 p.m., right after Danny Schechter's The News Dissector program. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you, and Happy New Year.
Thank you. Let's begin with your view about 2010 and what you would see as the success or failure of the Copenhagen and Cancun climate change summits. And also, for many, that marks a transition from climate change to climate shock. And this has made governments, in some respects, impotent to undertaking and agreeing on what constructively we can do in international agreements that really address global warming in an authentic way rather than just a political way. And also from there, if you would segue, and what do you foresee in American climate change policy for the coming year, particularly with the GOP-ruled Congress, which comprises lots of climate change deniers, and especially their supporters in the media, such as Glenn Beck, Sean Hannity, Laura Engstrom, all of the people on the right, Michael Savage, Mark Levine. They have a right to their opinion, and that I don't question, but my goodness, they don't have a right to interpret good science as supporting that there is no such thing as global problems or environmental problems, and to them, you never hear them address constructive ways of dealing with any environmental problem as if, let's not focus on that, that's not important. So could you address these, please?
Yes. I believe that 2010 will go down as that moment when we passed the point of no return on climate change. And I think that what happened in 2010 is that we had the perfect eco-political storm. We began to transition from climate change to climate shock. If you look at the heat waves that debilitated Russia, you look at the floods in Pakistan that covered 20% of the entire nation, you look at the volcanic eruption out of Iceland that closed down the airports in Northern Europe for a week. You look at even what happened over this last winter with the shutting down of airports and massive storms and floods as they're happening right now as we speak in Australia. We're no longer in a situation where we have a little bit of perturbation in the weather. We're now engaging in increasingly ferocious and increasingly frequent climate shock. So that's one part of it. What made it the perfect storm is that in the face of this reality, our governments completely capitulated to the financial interests and the manipulations of the right-wing demagogues who are denying that climate change even exists and supported by the oil industries and the Koch brothers, among others, have been spending millions of dollars to keep the situation in paralysis. I think that the perfect storm is going to continue to wreak havoc on the American political system. I think that the failure of the Obama administration to take the kind of transformational leadership for which he was elected and for which the world gave him a Nobel Peace Prize even before he came into office is really a catastrophic failure of leadership, the like of which I don't think we've had in our country for a very, very long time. Never before has a man come into the presidency with more moral or political capital, and I don't know of any example in recent memory where a president with that much moral and political capital so completely surrendered and squandered that opportunity, such that 2 years later, we have anger, we have the Tea Party, we have the resurgence of the right, and we're facing, Gary, I think the politics of paralysis over the next 2 years. The right wing are going to savage Obama. There's going to be no enlightened movement of the polity. They're going to be trying, as everyone knows, to repeal even the health bill. There will be no movement on climate change as the situation continues to get worse and worse. So I think that the situation that all of us need to internalize personally and collectively is, you know, January 1 just passed, 1111, marked not only the beginning of a new year, but the beginning of this next decade. And I think as we look forward to this next 10 years, we all need to understand that we're going to probably be going through perhaps the most turbulent decade, certainly in modern history, if not in human history. Because the climate change, moving the climate shock, and the winter we just have endured with airport closures and passengers stranded, not for a couple of hours, but for days, and unprecedented storms and weather events are only going to escalate. And at the same time, our governments are going to be more and more paralyzed. And that combination is going to be excruciating, and I believe that the most important thing any of us can really do now is, in addition to being informed of what's going on and taking the situation extremely seriously, connecting the dots, is we need to be building resilient community. We need to be understanding that the turbulence is going to increase and that we need to strategize for it because we have to navigate through it. So that's the challenge beginning with this year that I think will increase in intensity as we move through this decade.
I appreciate that insight. Thank you. Two questions that I would like you to join together. One is philosophical, one is very pragmatic. First, the pragmatic. When you look at the incidents of just the last month, the worst storms on record, the lowest temperatures, the most snow accumulating, even worse flooding in California and certain areas of California in their recorded history. Yeah. And then you start looking at what has happened in Europe, and now we have gotten to this place where tornadoes and hurricanes and storms and tsunamis and earthquakes have become so common that they no longer are seen as relevant. So we've lost that capacity to be concerned. We just kind of, we have made it the new normal. Oh, so, you know, the hottest day on record or the worst of firestorms in this area of the state. What does it mean when we no longer can see the significance of the environment and what impact it's going to have on us? And then add into that the second part. There are at least 13 states in the United States that, based upon the most accurate measurements, do not have enough water to sustain the growth or the continuation of industry, agriculture, and pedestrian use. And yet there is nothing being done of a concrete nature to change where all these people are living or how they're supposed to cope. There's just delaying tactics or some form of war between who really owns the water rights out of the Colorado and who's going to get the water when it comes out of Lake Mead, instead of saying, why do we keep encouraging people to move to a place that in 10 years they're going to be water rationing, and why don't we look at this honestly? So those are the two issues and that are pragmatic. The issue that is philosophical is this. What do we have to do to reignite a reconnection with our spiritual values so that we look at the world in a more comprehensive, humanistic, spiritual way instead of commodifying and commercializing and politicizing everything and everyone in it?
Well, I think those are two important questions. Starting with the pragmatic first, I think you're absolutely right. You know, each month of 2010 was the hottest on record. 17 countries comprising 20% of the landmass of the planet experienced record temperatures unprecedented in the history of record keeping. And situation is continuing to deteriorate because the amount of CO2 being put into the atmosphere is increasing, not decreasing. The abdication of the Obama administration and the leadership of the United States and not passing the climate bill basically signaled to the rest of the world that people can do anything they want regardless of consequence. And I think, Gary, the Jim Hansen, the chief scientist at NASA, is absolutely correct. These guys should be had up for crimes against humanity because they are forfeiting potentially human civilization itself just for short-term profit and gain. And we need to, all of your listeners need to understand that the weather, more than politics and economics, is going to control humanity's future, and it's going to be increasingly disruptive. Here in California, where I am, we're now in a situation of permanent drought. And the entire Southern California and San Joaquin Valley, all was built on the assumption of unlimited water. And in the last 25 years, the snow melt on the Sierra Nevadas has been reduced by 46%, and it's going down, down, down. And so we're looking in California at the greatest agricultural basin in the world turning into a desert in the next 20 to 30 years. And the L.A., you know, metropolitan area, which now supports 20, 25 million people, will probably shrink to 3 to 4, 5 million within the, by 2050. And don't forget, the coup de grace is not just extreme weather, but the oceans all over the world are rising. I had lunch yesterday with the vice president of the Maldives Islands, and not only do they have a budget item in their national budget to look for a new country, but they're now dealing with migrations of people who are seeing that the oceans are rising, the foundations of their houses are being eroded, and they know it's not going to stop. And so the Maldives Islands, people are already leaving. By 2020, 2025, when the oceans around San Francisco, New York, Miami, Houston, London, Paris, and people begin to really internalize that those oceans are not only going to rise, are rising, but they're not going to stop rising, then you're going to have a mass migration of people, the like of which the world has never known. And so we have got to get people to connect those dots, which leads to your philosophical question, which is, to me, the bottom line. I think that the reason why Wisdom University is doing what it's doing, and we really appreciate the opportunity to have our Voices of Wisdom, a weekly show on PRN. You're one of the heroes of our time, Gary. I just want to acknowledge that. You're consistently clear, you don't hold back, and you state with prophetic clarity and rigorous attention to detail what the truth of the matter is. If you look at the media on CNN and all these, it's like news has become a diversion from the truth to cloud people's capacity to understand what's really happening. So to have PRN out there telling people what is in an unvarnished way but in the constructive spirit could not be more important in our time, because we're going to be going through some very difficult situations, and it's going to be our spiritual grounding that is going to either lead us through or not, depending on how grounded we are. And I think that for us at Wisdom University, it's not the religious traditions, it is not the philosophical traditions that are going to aid us. It's our capacity to come into a realignment with the earth herself. You know, Gaia, as James Lovelock, you know, pointed out, is an intelligence. We're not organisms on the earth as an inert ball floating through space. The earth herself is a living, intelligent organism, and that we are part of her, and that as she begins to be disruptive, because we're upsetting the equilibrium of the atmosphere and the oceans in dramatic ways, to the degree to which we can realign ourselves with the tellurgic energies, with the energy of the earth itself, and build communities based on biomimicry, we should be patterning all of our human institutions, politics, economics, finance, on natural systems. That will enable us to understand the earth better, and I believe that to the degree to which we come into an alignment with the earth as small communities, that's going to enable us to navigate through the turbulence that is coming.
I absolutely agree with that, Jim. Thank you for those thoughtful words. If humanity is going to prepare, and I know many people in this audience are preparing, then they're going to look at the huge changes you've discussed on the horizon. They will not take it for granted. They will not become, let's say, disinclined by it. They will look at the water shortages, the food shortages, the lack of proper soil to grow food, the rising sea levels you mentioned around San Francisco and elsewhere. They'll look at the increased catastrophic storms, the extinction of more plant and animal life, and they're going to ask the same questions that you've asked us all to look at. How can we, in the plural, those of a like mind, and believe in spiritual sustainability, because without a spiritual sustainability, there is no sustainability. How can we get off the grid and de-addict ourselves to the stimulus and overstimulus of the high degree of living in the city and some of the suburbs, and go to a more rural, almost a more bucolic and pastoral life, and take the technologies we can benefit from, including the green,
exactly,
and in effect rewrite our life, and this time do it without the unnecessary and artificial and commercialized and rigidified rituals of before. Closing thought, please.
Totally. I mean, the transition town movement of communities, large and small, that are beginning to realize they've got to go off-grid. They've got to develop their own sustainable energy and food systems and ways of interacting with each other in community that are not dependent on the massive matrix industrial models that are out there. So you're absolutely right. And that level of community, I think, is what's going to see us through. And as it'll turn out, ironically, to the degree to which we simplify, get closer to the earth, we'll discover anew the meaning of happiness and contentment as we approach each other and the earth herself with a renewed vitality.
Thank you very much. I look forward to your new program premiering on the Later this month, I believe it's on the 28th, and
yes.
You'll be following Danny Schechter, and that's a very good hour, and so we look forward to that. In the interim, if people want more information, please give us your website. Your website, Jim? I think he's off a line there. Jim Garrison is my guest, Wisdom University in San Francisco. I want to thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more with you. Have a wonderful afternoon, everyone.
I'm just mad about saffron. Oh, saffron's mad about me. I'm just mad about saffron. She's just mad about me. They call me mellow yellow, quite rightly. They call me mellow yellow, quite rightly. They call me mellow yellow.
Is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Carol Lee.
She's just mad about me. They call me mellow yellow. They call me mellow.